Welcome to That Medic Podcast, your bi-weekly dose
of all things digital health, global health, and leadership.
My name is Success, a student at Cambridge University.
And I am Simmer, a student at Harvard University.
Join us as we chat with some top professionals in healthcare. Enjoy.
In this podcast, we spoke to Dr. Dave Choksi and Adam Beckman, who served as New York City Health Commissioner and Special Advisor to the U.S. Surgeon General, respectively. We discussed how they first got interested in health policy, their recent paper in JAMA Health Forum on hospital never events, and how they're working to make sure that hospitals are truly places of healing and not agents of harm. Today's show is perfect for anyone excited about healthcare reform or just intrigued about policy generally. So without further ado, let's have a listen. Hi, Adam and Dr. Choksi. Welcome to the show. Thank you so much for finding the time to speak with us. So we normally start the podcast by asking the question, why did you decide to go into medicine? Why don't we start with you, Dr. Choksi?
Sure. Well, look, I was the first doctor in my family. So, you know, I didn't have early role models of what it meant to practice medicine. And, you know, frankly, when I got to medical school, that was really my real exposure, you know, to the day-to-day life of practicing medicine. But I was always motivated by the idea of health. And I saw so many examples in my, you know, my personal life, my parents' health, my family members' health, as well as some formative early experiences in my career about how fundamentally health is connected to opportunity. So even though I love taking care of patients, that's really been sort of the animating idea that drove me to medicine in the first place and to some of the other interests that I know we'll discuss, that health is connected to opportunity.
Well, and first of all, let me say, Simmer, thank you for having us both here. We're thrilled to get to be with you. And I think, you know, you'll hear a similar narrative from many people. And for me, medicine drew me in ultimately for its values. I think for values that I grew up with in my family around listening, around investing in relationships, around social justice as a core part of the work that I knew I wanted to do, whatever I did. I learned this from different people in my family, including my grandmother, who worked as a social worker. And she absolutely showed me in many different ways as I grew up about the value of working to give voice to people who don't have one or can't be heard. And that example was what drew me into medicine. And it's what has kept me here through, as you know, many, many years of training in many different phases. And, you know, we'll talk about what it looks like to combine experiences that are clinical with experiences in the private sector, with experiences in government. But through all of that, I've found that the cliche about medicine and having the opportunity to be in a hospital, to be in a clinic, is grounding and can be a source of hope and optimism in moments of frustration in a sort of large, complicated, dysfunctional system. I found that to be true and continue to cherish that very much.
No, thanks for sharing that. And I certainly want to talk more about both your excellent experiences in health policy. But before we go there, I know that you both recently published a piece in JAMA Health Forum entitled A New Category of Never Events, Ending Harmful Hospital Policies. Adam, could you briefly summarize that argument?
Absolutely, yes. This is a concept that Dave and I have been thinking about and talking about for some time. And the crux is that 20 years ago, the National Quality Forum put together this list of medical never events. These were problems like leaving a sponge inside of a patient after surgery. And we've been looking around and feeling like there is an equivalent concept of never events that applies to healthcare systems more broadly, and particularly hospitals. Obviously, there are a number of different actors in the healthcare system that are engaged in behaviors that are troubling and problematic. And we think because of the frequency of what we're seeing from some hospitals, it's important that we talk about them. And I can lay out what the five are that we identified, and Dave can add. The five that we focused on is one, never aggressively pursuing medical debt from low-income patients or people who are having difficulty affording their medical bills. So that's hospital systems that are suing patients, that are aggressively, you know, garnishing wages, denying care due to owed debt. The second never event is never spend less on community benefits, like providing care to uninsured patients or funding local public health programs, than a hospital earns from tax breaks from being a nonprofit, right? So many hospitals have a nonprofit status, even if they're a multi-billion dollar institution. Third is never flout federal requirements for hospitals to be transparent with patients about the costs of their care. We can talk about more in this one in more detail in the recent rules that have come out on this topic. The fourth is never provide compensation worth less than a living wage for hospital workers, including food serving employees, janitors. And the final one is never deliver racially segregated medical care, where a hospital systematically is underserving its surrounding communities of color. And these are meant to be provocative and thought-provoking. And we know, you know, these are complicated topics, but we think this is also the floor, not the ceiling, of what we believe hospitals should be able to stand for.
You know, I feel so fortunate to have had the chance to work with Adam on this this piece, and you know, I hope some will read it after this podcast. But we're really interested in, you know, translating this into action in the real world, and that's the stimulus, you know, for us having tried to put this out into the world in the first place. Like so many others, particularly clinicians, you know, we've been frustrated and dismayed at you know, some of what we're seeing with respect to the growing financialization of healthcare. And so, you know, for hospitals, I think it can be unequivocally said that hospitals should be places for healing, not agents of harm. And so we tried to use this frame of medical never events to point out that there's precedent for addressing harm in hospitals. That was a very focusing campaign, essentially around the idea that there are some practices that should just be rendered unacceptable. And in the modern era, you know, the five practices that that Adam laid out, we think are a starting point, you know, for how we should think about what should be unacceptable going forward. Just one more note, which is, you know, I work in a hospital myself. I saw the bravery, you know, the heroism that so many people who work in hospitals demonstrated, particularly during the COVID-19 pandemic. Just an exceptional, you know, capability of serving people in a time of crisis and in their time of need. And so, you know, our argument is to say that the spirit of care and compassion that pervades, you know, so many hospitals should be brought to bear when it comes to these types of policies as well.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. And, you know, Adam, I think you put it really well in both describing it as provocative and the floor, right? It's sad that the floor is so provocative, but I think it reinforces why this piece was so important. And, you know, it's interesting because I think there has been, in my eyes, increasing attention to these sort of, as you term it, these hospital never events, right? There's a New York Times article in September 2022, which discussed the Providence hospital system and sort of, as you're describing, the debt collection of the sort of lowest resourced patients. So I think it's really important. And I really like the framework you provided. And this piece, of course, you call for policy action. And as Dr. Choksi, you mentioned, you want to go beyond, you want just the words on the page and to actually working towards eradicating these never events. I think it's challenging because, as you both know well, right, there's hospitals' lack of compliance on price transparency rules. For some time now, there have been lawsuits over the No Surprises Act that Congress passed. So it seems like it's quite difficult to compel good behavior from hospitals. So given that context, what might policy action to reduce these hospital never events look like in practice? And why do you think it would work?
Yeah, I'm happy to start on this one. And, you know, let's talk about the policies, but let's also make sure that the starting point is that hospitals can take these actions themselves. And another parallel with, you know, the clinical never events from 20 years ago is that there were visionary hospital leaders who said enough is enough, you know, and took matters into their own hands to really drive improvement in that era. And we do need to see, you know, similar actions being taken. And I hope that, you know, part of what our article accomplishes is to get some other hospital leaders to step up right now with respect to eliminating these administrative never events. But we, you know, have enough experience in this realm to also know that that is likely to have to be married to policy action to really drive change at the scale that is warranted, you know, for these types of practices. And so we can think of a number of different ways that that might happen, particularly at the state and the federal levels. You know, at the state level, we've already seen some action from offices of attorneys general in specific states to curb some of the most egregious practices. We've also seen some, you know, nascent but spreading legislative initiatives. For example, Colorado passed some legislation specifically trying to make it very clear that flouting the federal price transparency law should be unacceptable. And then at the federal level, you know, the way that we saw medical never events really be baked in to the reimbursement system was through CMS action. So, you know, so that's a mechanism that that we have in mind as well.
And I think we share what you were getting at, Simmer. I think that federal action can be hard and challenging. And that's why you're hearing from Dave this enthusiasm we have about the possibility for state-by-state actions, both on the legislative side and from an enforcement mechanism. And, you know, there are so many possibilities there, both concrete actions that have already occurred, as well as efforts that are underway. There's legislation in New York right now related to medical billing that's exciting. But, you know, we also recognize that ultimately, right, the real long-term solution here is reform around the healthcare system, the payment system broadly. That's creating these fundamental incentives to have to go after that additional revenue, to have to go after medical billing. And we're completely aligned with, I would argue, hospitals and leaders across the industry that, you know, that is the ultimate problem here. At the same time, when we hear about people and families that are making difficult decisions between childcare and getting the medical care that they need, that necessitates that action be taken sooner and right away.
Certainly. And I think that's a really good point about how sort of it's a combination approach of both the healthcare systems themselves, right, the state action, and then maybe at some level also federal action as well. You can't have any one without the other, and it's good to have all of them going simultaneously. And I want to also ask you about, as you argue in your piece, you mentioned that hospitals should be addressing patients' social drivers of health as well as reducing administrative events. That they can't be doing one and not the other. So I'm really curious, do you think that addressing these social determinants of health should be the responsibility of the healthcare system as opposed to, say, the government or nonprofits? And if so, how do you financially incentivize this work? Because hospitals are increasingly profit-driven, even under the moniker of nonprofits.
I'm happy to start, and then Dave, please jump in. I mean, I think that broadly, there's a narrative that's been floating around now for several years, right? Started perhaps, or some people would credit winners take all, which is a narrative of, it's important to focus on the harm that an institution is creating before or at the same time as considering additional investments that do quote unquote good and do good in a way that's flashy and public and gains credit and attention. And we feel that related to hospitals, right? A, you know, uncomfortable reality is that there are hospitals that on the one hand may be providing a free taxi ride to help overcome transportation barriers to one patient, and at that same moment suing another patient, or perhaps the same patient for medical debt. And something about that just does not feel okay. And as we've contemplated this, we've started to feel that a hospital's first responsibility should be to stop creating more social harm. Obviously, there is immense opportunity and examples of hospitals that have gone so far beyond that and are implementing outstanding social determinants of health and programs addressing social determinants of health and helping the people that they care for to lead healthier, more safe and comfortable lives outside of the clinic. Dave, what else would you add on that front?
Yeah, Adam, I think that was well described. I'll just, you know, take another piece of what I heard in Simmer's question, which is, you know, how much is this the responsibility of the healthcare system in the first place? And, you know, I have a particular vantage point on this because I started the first social determinants of health team at New York City Health and Hospitals, which is the public healthcare system for New York City. And I'm so proud of the work that group has done to address food insecurity, you know, the economic travails that, you know, so many low-income patients and families encounter, transportation barriers. We expanded a medical legal partnership at Health and Hospitals. And all of this is vitally important work, particularly when you're talking about public healthcare system or other safety net systems. But as Adam was alluding to, you know, it also has taken on this inflection, perhaps in other systems that are more profit driven, of having the veneer of addressing social drivers when in fact the most impactful thing that can happen is to stop creating social harms. So, you know, there have been countless examples over the last few years of hospital systems issuing press releases about, you know, their food pharmacy or, you know, something that they're doing to address housing. And those can be, you know, components of a broader ecosystem of addressing social determinants of health, but only after we in healthcare have taken responsibility for all of the ways in which, you know, we may have been setting back the drivers of health that can contribute to illness.
And Simmer, if I can, one other point I think Dave and I would layer on here is that, as Dave was saying before, we see a big distinction between the policies we are referring to in hospitals and the people that work in hospitals, right? We are not suggesting that a hospital that has a policy we would consider harmful necessarily means that the doctors and the nurses and the techs that work there are sort of complicit in creating that harm and the important and really beneficial work they are doing and busting every day in order to get there on time and giving up nights with family is not sufficient, right? These are fundamentally people that are working really hard more often than not to try to do the right thing by patients. But as Dave said, we believe that hospitals should not be places of harm. And that's why we think it's so important to call this out.
Right. It's separating out the institution from the people, right? Because the people are not responsible for the physicians and nurses are not the ones sending the debt collection notices or suing, of course. And this has been a fascinating discussion. And I want to talk a little bit more about your broader health policy experience and time in government. For example, Adam, I know you served as special advisor to the Surgeon General. And Dr. Choksi, you were, of course, the health commissioner of New York City. So I'm interested to both of you. How did you first get interested in health policy and what appealed to you most about it? Maybe we can start with Dr. Choksi.
Sure. Well, you know, not dissimilar to you, Simmer. You know, I in my undergraduate years, I you know, tried to marry a love of science with, you know, if it's not hyperbolic to describe it this way, a love for my fellow man. And you know, I had a number of experiences that that showed me that science was not enough and innovation was not enough. Particularly, you know, when I was in college, it was literally the turn of the century. You know, it was a time that we were in another pandemic, the HIV/AIDS pandemic, and we had these miraculous medicines, antiretrovirals for HIV, that were described as having a Lazarus effect because they brought people back from the brink of death. And I remember spending time in parts of sub-Saharan Africa and Asia and seeing that the people and the places that were in greatest need of these miraculous breakthroughs were not getting it. And that's a problem not of science or innovation, but of delivery and access and policy. And so that was really the impetus for me, in part because it felt like actually the most challenging problems were not to be found in the immunology lab where I spent hours upon hours, you know, pipetting from one tube to another, but rather, you know, to solve those much more human challenges with respect to how to wrangle our systems, how to improve our bureaucracies, and actually get, you know, these life-saving breakthroughs where they were most needed. And that's really been, you know, such an animating idea throughout my career, to be able to say that, you know, whether it was antiretrovirals for HIV, or the new curative therapies for hepatitis C, or of course the mRNA vaccines for COVID-19, that's really just the first step in trying to save lives and prevent suffering.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Adam?
I was recently revisiting an article that Ed Young wrote in The Atlantic last fall, and he talks about the origins of public health, and many of the same themes that Dave just described appear in that article. He actually interviews a public health historian at Columbia named David Rosner, who says that in the beginning, public health was, you know, he has this quote that it was about people who were united by a simple yet radical notion that some people were more susceptible to disease because of social problems. And he goes on to describe this, quote, moral certainty regarding the need to act that drew so many people to public health. And I think you hear it from Dave, and that was absolutely what bit by bit pulled me into this world as well, as an undergraduate. And then afterwards, some of the initial projects that I got involved in were related to those new hepatitis C medications that Dave just talked about, and working on access to those medications in prisons and jails where the hepatitis C epidemic is so profoundly uncontrolled, and yet opportunity to access those medications, is so limited. We found that less than 1% of people who qualified or needed those medications were able to get them. And that's continued to be a theme for me in the different issues and that I've gotten to work on. And it's a motivator for many of the people I've gotten to work with, which makes it such a joy to get to be on a journey with people that you share those values with.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. I'm actually really curious, how did you two meet each other?
You go ahead, Dave.
Well, Adam and I crossed paths, but I have to say, you know, his reputation as a brilliant student preceded him. We were introduced by Dr. Howie Foreman at Yale, and we had the chance to actually work on a, you know, a federal campaign on the Biden campaign in the summer of 2020. We met virtually, and like actually a number of relationships just in modern day, but particularly during the pandemic, you know, we probably exchanged hundreds of emails before we actually met one another in person. And, you know, what struck me, even though Adam is much younger than I am, was just how, not just how hardworking and intelligent he is, but how wise, you know, and thoughtful and careful he was with respect to the work that we were able to do together.
Right. And I want to ask you about that work a little bit more, because I know that both of you served in government doing this health policy work during the pandemic itself, which I imagine must have been stressful at times. I'm really curious, what were some of the biggest challenges that you remember from that time? And more specifically, what were the lessons you took out from those experiences? Adam, maybe we can start with you.
Happy to, though. I'm eager to also hear Dave reflect on his time as commissioner in New York during the thick of the pandemic. But, you know, one of the biggest challenges that came up over and over and over again is coordination. I was working in the federal government in the Department of Health and Human Services with the Surgeon General of the United States, and we were working very closely with the White House COVID response team. And, you know, there are quite literally thousands of people across the federal government that are tasked with critical jobs and functions related to public health, especially in the midst of a pandemic. And many of these people are working really, really hard. I can't tell you how many people I encountered that had been working the equivalent of, you know, 18-hour days, no weekend for going on, you know, 18 months or 2 years. And many of these people are invisible, right? And it's easy to kind of have this image of government as just this sort of vague thing that is the CDC or is the FDA or is our publicly elected officials. But behind the scenes, it's a lot of humans. It's just a lot of humans that are trying to figure out how to get us from point A to point B. And to answer your question, coordination and the pace of coordination that needs to happen and the stakes of that coordination is the challenge that we grappled with, I thought, over and over and over again. And I'm happy to say more about that, but I want to give Dave a chance to reflect on his role in the spotlight as well.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Adam. It really resonates, you know, particularly how many people just have their heads down and do the work of public service, you know, that all of us benefit from each day. It was a privilege for me to be a part of that. You know, I served as New York City's health commissioner through most of the COVID-19 pandemic. You know, our team led New York City's vaccination campaign, which was the largest vaccination campaign in the history of our city, and you know, saved countless lives of our neighbors, our friends, you know, our family members, and you know, it was very motivating work. The type of work that when you woke up in the morning, even if you'd only slept a couple of hours and were exhausted, it was easy to get out of bed because you knew that every single thing that you did better or more of would really make a difference, you know, for the people that you were aiming to serve. But I do want to convey that it was extraordinarily difficult, you know, for me and for many others. You know, like many other public health officials, I received threats. My wife actually received threats as well. You know, she's an educator, and so some of the policies that that I was responsible for that affected schools, you know, she sort of bore the brunt of people who were dissatisfied with that. We encountered protests, particularly for our more aggressive vaccination policies in the latter part of 2021. I was sued more times than I can count. I asked my general counsel to, you know, keep track of all of the lawsuits that I was named in, and pretty soon, you know, we lost count. So all of that is difficult, you know, to go through, not just on a professional level, but very much on a personal level as well. And the thing that I would just distill out of that experience is how important it is to nourish your convictions, to do that at every point that you can throughout your career. And this takes different forms. You know, it can be reading the writers that you most admire that resonate with your values. It can be, as Adam has alluded to, surrounding yourself with people who reflect your best self and your values back to me, back to you, particularly when the going gets extraordinarily tough. And then, you know, in those very difficult times, a lot of it is relying on your family, your closest colleagues, to lift you up, and reciprocally, you know, for you to lift them up. But the strength of your convictions, much more so than how shiny your credentials are, that's what gets you through, particularly during times of crisis.
Mm-hmm. No, that's really inspirational. Thanks for sharing that. You know, I also want to ask, as we're wrapping up, Dr. Choksi, you are, of course, a physician. Adam, you're in training to become a physician. How do you think your health policy work informs your clinical practice and vice versa? Because there's plenty of people that do health policy work that don't have the medical training.
Yeah, I'm happy to give a brief response. And I know we're starting to get tight on time. You know, I'm in the thick still of medical training, right? I'm not yet a physician, but still I can say that the pairing is magical. And I mean that because if you are in the position that Dave is describing or a more minor version of it, having that grounding to be back in clinic and the relationships with patients and that those experiences are fuel. And at the same time, moments in the hospital where, you know, it's 9 p.m. at night, the fax machine is driving you crazy, you're banging your head up against prior authorization or some, you know, ungodly frustration, having opportunities that allow you to also step back and focus on addressing some of those more systematic barriers is really heartening and inspirational. So, you know, I think from what I've seen and the people I've worked with who have been able to make a life out of this combination, it can be really empowering and a source of ongoing hope.
Mm-hmm. And Simmer, you know, your question reminds me of a decade ago in 2012, I was sitting in the Roosevelt room of the White House. I was a White House fellow working at the VA, the Department of Veterans Affairs. And I was, you know, sort of the secretary's delegate to this working group on implementation of the Affordable Care Act. Remember, this was not too long after the ACA had been passed. And, you know, after I got over the initial awe of being in the Roosevelt room and, you know, just the experience that entailed, my next reaction was to kind of take a scan around and realize that I was, even though I was just fresh out of residency, I was the person who had the most clinical training, you know, of anyone sitting around the table. And that really left an impression on me that here we were talking about implementation, you know, like how this policy is actually going to hit the ground, where that clinical experience is vitally important, you know, to be able to shape conversations like that one. And so I hope by, you know, sharing that, it's motivation for people who know you love taking care of patients, who are getting into medicine, you know, because you want to be an excellent clinician, that there is so much that you have to offer, you know, in health policy conversations like that one. And then vice versa, just briefly, I'll say, you know, every single patient care session that I have, I am thankful that I have this other outlet to sublimate, you know, the frustrations of what you encounter, you know, as Adam was alluding to as well, to be able to take the things that we know should work better for our patients and actually try to surmount those barriers and create different structures. And so it's a real privilege, you know, for anyone who gets to move between those worlds because each of them is enhanced by the other.
Certainly. And I think that nearly wraps up the episode. So very quickly, wanted to ask, Dr. Choksi, what are your three pieces of advice for students interested in health policy?
Sure. Well, the first one I'll just reiterate, it's far more important to nourish your convictions than it is to burnish your credentials. The second one that comes to mind is really about public service. And I hate to use a football analogy because I know it's a barbaric game, but the football analogy is it's like being a running back. You know, like being a good running back, you always have to keep your legs pumping is what they say, because often you're stuck, you know, just at the line of scrimmage. But then all of a sudden, something will open up and you'll have a chance, you know, to sprint down the field. And that's what public service is like, because often it feels like you're not making a lot of progress until, you know, you get that break and you have to be ready. You have to keep the legs pumping to take advantage of it. And then the last one is simply, you know, when things feel like you're not making progress or the deck is stacked against you. The mantra that always plays over and over in my mind is, it's better to light a single candle than curse the darkness. And anytime it feels like, like I need a little bit of help, that is what I reach for, to remind myself that whether it's my one patient, you know, the clinic that I'm a part of, the community that I'm living in, there's always a place to light that first candle.
What a wonderful note to end on. Thank you both for coming. Hey everyone, thanks for listening to this podcast. Make sure to subscribe, rate us, and leave a review. You can also head to the description of this podcast to follow us on all social media so that you don't miss out on any of our content.